at intervals. After a little while it appeared that a battery had received the signal. One heavy shell after another came at us on a flat trajectory with incredible fury. We crouched in our refuges and could do nothing. Now and then we lit a cigar and threw it away again. Every moment we expected a rush of earth to bury us. The sleeve of Schmidt's coat was torn by a big splinter. At the third shot, the occupant of the next hole to mine was buried by a terrific explosion. We dug him out instantly, but the weight of earth had killed him. His face had fallen in and looked like a death's head. It was the volunteer Simon. Tribulation had made him wise. Whenever, in the course of the day, when airmen were about, anyone stirred from his cover, Simon was heard scolding, and his warning fist appeared from behind the ground sheet that curtained his earth. At 3 in the afternoon the men came in from the left flank and said they could stick it no longer as their shelters were shot to bits. It cost me all my callousness to get them back to their posts. Just before 10 at night the left flank of the regimental front was heavily shelled, and after 20 minutes we came in for it too. In a brief space we were completely covered in dust and smoke, and yet most of the hits were just in front or just behind. While this hurricane was raging, I went along my platoon front. The men were standing, rifle in hand, as though carved in stone, their eyes fixed on the ground in front of them. Now and then, by the light of a rocket, I saw the gleam of helmet after helmet, bayonet after bayonet, and I was filled with pride at commanding this handful of men that might very likely be pounded into the earth, but could not be conquered. It is in such moments that the human spirit triumphs over the mightiest demonstrations of material force. The fragile body, steeled by the will, stands up to the most terrific punishment. Sergeant Major H., the unfortunate rat-catcher of Monchy, who was with the platoon on our left, intended to fire a white Very light. By mistake he fired a red one, and this signal was taken up on all sides. At once our barrage came down to a tune which delighted us. One shell after another went howling over our heads and crashed in sparks and splinters over the ground in front of us. A mixture of dust, suffocating gases, and vaporous exhalations of corpses flung high in the air was blown back on us from the shell holes. After this orgy of destruction, the fire returned to its customary level, and stayed there all the night and the next day. One man, in a moment of agitation, had released the whole mighty machinery of war. H. remained what he was, an unlucky fellow. That same night he shot a Very light into the leg of his boot while loading the pistol, and had to be carried back, severely burnt. Next day it rained hard, and we were not sorry. With the laying of the dust, the parched feeling was relieved, and the great clusters of bluebottles which the sun had brought out were driven away. I sat nearly all day in front of my earth on the ground, smoking and eating, too, with appetite, in spite of my surroundings. The next morning, Fusilier Knieke of my platoon got a bullet from somewhere through the chest. It hit the spine, too, and paralyzed his legs. When I went to see him, he was lying in one of the shelter holes, quite resigned. In the evening, when he was being carried back, he had a leg broken on one of the many occasions when his bearers had to take cover from the shell fire. He died at the dressing station. At midday, a man of my platoon got me to have a shot at a single Englishman in Guillemont railway station. When I looked, I saw hundreds of English hurrying forward along a shallow communication trench. They were not particularly upset by the rifle fire we could bring to bear on them. This sight showed the unequal terms on which we fought, for if we had ventured on anything like it, our men would have been shot to pieces in a few minutes. While on our side not a captive balloon was to be seen, on the English side there were 30 at once over one spot, observing every movement with Argus eyes, and at once directing a hail of iron upon it. In the evening a big shell splinter came hurtling for my stomach, but fortunately it was pretty well spent and fell to the ground after striking the buckle of my belt. Two members of an English ration party who had lost their way appeared at dusk on No. 1 platoon front. Both were shot down at point-blank range. One of them fell half into the sunken road, while his legs remained on the top of the ditch. None of the men would take prisoners, for how could we get them through the barrage? It was bad enough on our own without prisoners to see to. Towards 1 in the morning I was roused from a confused sleep by Schmidt. I jumped up nervously and seized my rifle. It was our relief. We handed over what there was to hand over, and departed with all speed from this corner of hell. We had scarcely reached the shallow communication trench when the first group of shrapnel burst among us. The man in front of me reeled from a wound in the wrist from which the blood spurted. He wanted to fall out and lie down. I caught him by the arm and got him to his feet in spite of his dazed condition, and did not let him go until I handed him over in the dressing station near battle headquarters. It was hard work in both of the sunken roads, and we got quite out of breath. The tightest corner of all was when we found ourselves in a hollow where shrapnel and light shells were coming over all the time. Brook, brook. The rain of iron crashed round us, scattering a shower of sparks in the darkness. Ooh-wee, another volley. We stopped, breathless, for I knew a fraction of a second in advance, from the sharpening intensity of sound, that the descending curve of the shell would end just where I stood. Immediately after, there was a heavy crash at my very feet, and the soft earth was flung high. This one of all others was a dud. A better opportunity could not be wished for making the influence of an officer tell. Everywhere relieved and reliefs were hurrying through the shells and the darkness, some of them utterly lost and dazed with excitement and exhaustion. Everywhere voices rang out, in command or in monotonous supplication from the shell holes where the wounded were left to their fate. As we rushed by, I gave information to those who had lost their way, pulled man out of shell holes, threatened to shoot any who wanted to fall out, kept shouting my name to keep my men together, and at last, as though by a miracle, I got my platoon back to Comble. From Comble, we still had to march beyond Sailly and the government farm to the forest of Henoise, where we were to bivouac. And now our exhausted condition made itself felt in earnest. We shuffled bitterly along the road with hanging heads. Motor cars and ammunition columns crowded us to the ditch. In a kind of nervous distemper, I was convinced that the transport rattling by pushed us to one side so roughly, only out of spite. And more than once I surprised myself with my finger on the trigger of my revolver. When our march was done, we still had tents to pitch before we could throw ourselves down on the hard ground. During our time under canvas in this forest bivouac, there were heavy downfalls of rain. The straw in the tents began to rot, and several of the men went sick. We five company officers were a little put out by the dampness. Every evening we sat on our kit bags under canvas behind a battery of bottles. We went back to Comble after 3 days, where I occupied, with my platoon, 4 smallish cellars. The first morning it was comparatively quiet, so I took a little walk through the devastated gardens and plundered an espalier of some delicious peaches. On my wanderings I got into a house surrounded by tall hedges, where a lover of beautiful old things must have lived. On the walls of the rooms there was a collection of painted plates, such as they love in northern France, holy water basins, copper plate engravings, and nativities carved in wood. There were stores of old china, and lovely old leather bindings were scattered about the floor. a fine old Don Quixote among them. It was a pity to leave all these treasures to destruction. When I got back, I found that the men had marauded the gardens on their own account, and had now made a stew of bully and vegetables, in which there were potatoes, beans, carrots, artichokes, and many kinds of green vegetables. While we were eating, a shell hit the house, and three fell close by. But we paid little attention, for the surfeit of such sensations had blunted us. The house must have seen some casualties already, for a newly carved cross stood on a heap of debris in the middle room, with a list of names carved in the wood. At noon on the next day I went to the house of the collector of china, and got a volume of the illustrated Petit Journal. It is to be found in nearly every French household, and it abounds in villainous bad taste. I then established myself in a room that still held together, lit a small fire of broken furniture, and began to read. I often had to shake my head, for I had stumbled on the numbers printed while the Fashoda affair was on. At about 7 I turned the last page and went into a little room at the top of the cellar steps, where the men were cooking at a little fireplace. I had scarcely joined them when there was a loud report in front of the door of the house, and at the same moment I felt a violent blow on my left calf. Shouting out that I was hit, I jumped down the cellar steps with my pipe still in my mouth. A light was lit in a moment, and the matter looked into. There was a ragged hole in my putties, from which blood ran on to the ground. On the other side there was the round swelling of a shrapnel bullet under the skin. The men bound me up and took me under fire to the catacombs, where our Surgeon Major General took me in hand. Lieutenant Vettier, who happened to be passing by, held my hand while the bullet was cut out with knife and scissors. The surgeon congratulated me, for the bullet had passed between the shin and the fibula without any injury to the bone. "Habent sua fata libelle et bale," remarked the old corps student with a grunt, as he handed me over to an orderly to be dressed. To my great joy, many of my men came to say good-bye to me while I lay on a stretcher in a recess of the catacombs, waiting for dusk. My honored colonel, Von Open, too, paid me a visit. When evening came, I was carried to the outskirts of the town and put on a Red Cross wagon. The driver, without paying any heed to the cries of the occupants, went at full speed over the paved road, but it was being shelled, and neither shell holes nor other obstructions could stop him. Finally, we were taken on by motor to the village of Bans, and laid in the church, which was already crowded with wounded. A nurse told me that over 30,000 wounded had passed through Bans in the last few days. In the face of such figures, I could not think much of the wound in my leg. From there I got to Saint-Quentin, whose windows shook in the incessant thunder of battle, and thence again in a hospital train to Guerre, where I received the best possible attention in the garrison hospital. I heard the subsequent fate of my company from friends in the other battalions who were wounded after I was. It was put back into the line on the day after I got my wound, and suffered severe losses marching up and also during 10 hours' drum fire. It was then attacked from all sides, owing to the large gaps in the line. Little Schmidt, Fehnrich, Wolgemuth, Lieutenants Vogel and Sievers, in fact nearly the whole company, had died fighting to the last. A few survivors only, Lieutenant Vettier among them, were taken prisoners. Not one man got back to Combles to tell the tale of this heroic fight that was fought to the finish with such bitterness. Even the English army command made honorable mention of the handful of men who held out to the last near Guillemont. I was no doubt glad of the chance shot that withdrew me, as if by a miracle, from certain death on the very eve of the engagement. At the same time, strange as it may sound, I would willingly have shared the fate of my comrades and stood with them shoulder to shoulder while the iron dice of war rolled over us. Instead of this, I kept the unquenchable fame of these men as my reminder, in the worst moments of the sanguinary conflicts that were yet in store, that I must show myself always worthy to have been their comrade. It was the days at Guillemont that first made me aware of the overwhelming effects of the war of material. We had to adapt ourselves to an entirely new phase of war. The communications between the troops and the staff, between the artillery and the liaison officers, were utterly crippled by the terrific fire. Dispatch carriers failed to get through the hail of metal, and telephone wires were no sooner laid than they were shot into pieces. Even light signalling was put out of action by the clouds of smoke and dust that hung over the field of battle. There was a zone of a kilometer behind the front line where explosives held absolute sway. Even the regimental staff only knew exactly where we had been and how the line ran when we came back after 3 days and told them. Under such circumstances, accuracy of artillery fire was out of the question. We were also entirely in the dark about the English line, though often, without our knowing it, it was only a few meters from us. Sometimes a Tommy, feeling his way from one shell hole to another like an ant along a track in the sand, landed in one that we occupied, and vice versa, for our front line consisted merely of isolated and unconnected bits that were easily mistaken. Once seen, the landscape is an unforgettable one. In this neighborhood of villages, meadows, woods, and fields, there was literally not a bush or a tiniest blade of grass to be seen. Every hand's breadth of ground had been churned up again and again. Trees had been uprooted, smashed, and ground to touchwood. The houses blown to bits and turned to dust. Hills had been leveled, and the arable land made a desert. And yet the strangest thing of all was not the horror of the landscape in itself, but the fact that these scenes, such as the world had never known before, were fashioned by men who intended them to be a decisive end to the war. Thus all the frightfulness that the mind of man could devise was brought into the field, and there, where lately there had been the idyllic picture of rural peace, there was as faithful a picture of the soul of scientific war. In earlier wars, certainly, towns and villages had been burned. But what was that compared with this sea of craters dug out by machines? For even in this fantastic desert, there was the sameness of the machine-made article. A shell hole strewn with bully tins, broken weapons, fragments of uniform, and dud shells, with one or two dead bodies on its edge. This was the never-changing scene that surrounded each one of all these hundreds of thousands of men. And it seemed that man on this landscape he had himself created became different, more mysterious and hardy and callous than in any previous battle. The spirit and the tempo of the fighting altered, and after the Battle of the Somme, the war had its own peculiar impress that distinguished it from all other wars. After this battle, the German soldier wore the steel helmet, and in his features there were chiseled the lines of an energy stretched to the utmost pitch, lines that future generations will perhaps find as fascinating and imposing as those of many heads of classical or Renaissance times. But I cannot too often repeat. A battle was no longer an episode that spent itself in blood and fire. It was a condition of things that dug itself in remorselessly week after week, and even month after month. What was a man's life in this wilderness whose vapor was laden with the stench of thousands upon thousands of decaying bodies? Death lay in ambush for each one in every shell hole, merciless, and making one merciless in turn. Chivalry here took a final farewell. It had to yield to the heightened intensity of war, just as all fine and personal feeling has to yield when machinery gets the upper hand. The Europe of today appeared here, for the first time on the field of battle. The terrible losses, out of all proportion to the breadth of front attacked, were principally due to the old Prussian obstinacy with which the tactics of the lines were pursued to their logical conclusion. One battalion after another was crowded up into a front line already overmanned, and in a few hours pounded to bits. It was a long while before the folly of contesting worthless strips of ground was recognized. It was finally given up and the principle of a mobile defense adopted. The last development of this was the elastic distribution of the defense in zones. Thus it was that there were never again such bitterly contested engagements as those that for weeks together were fought out round shell-shot woods or undecipherable ruins. The names of the tiniest Picardy hamlets are memorials of heroic battles to which the history of the world can find no parallel. There it was that the dust first drank the blood of our trained and disciplined youth. Those fine qualities which had raised the German race to greatness leapt up once more in dazzling flame, and then slowly went out in a sea of mud and blood. St. Pierre Vast. After 14 days in hospital and as long on leave, I went back to the regiment, which was now in the line near Dieu-Nud, quite close to the well-known Grand Tranchée. After my arrival, it remained 2 days there, and at the same time in the old mountain town of Hattonchâtel. Then we entrained at Mars-la-Tour for the Somme region once more. We detrained at Bohain again, and went into quarters in the village of Brancourt nearby. This was a neighborhood we often touched upon in later days. It was agricultural, and yet there was a loom in nearly every house. The inhabitants did not appeal to me. They were dirty and of a very low moral development. I was billeted on a cottage where lived a man and his wife and their daughter. I must own that in return for my money they made me most excellent dishes of eggs. The daughter told me over the first cup of coffee that she was going to drink a good coffee with Poincaré after his return, by which she meant give him a piece of her mind. I have never heard anyone so fluent in abuse as this filia hospitalis, particularly on the topic of a neighbor whom she accused of having lived in a certain street of Saint-Quentin. She sputtered while she raged round the room, stretching out her hands like claws in the vain search for an object on which to vent her wrath. In the morning, when this Rose of Brancourt was busied making butter or some other domestic matter, she looked unbelievably uninviting. Yet in the afternoon, when it came to parading the village street with pride or visiting her friends, the ugly grub had turned into the splendid butterfly. I always observed with some mistrust a large box of rice powder that never left the table, for it seemed to me to be a complete substitute for soap and water. One day the father begged me to forward an indictment to the town major, complaining of a neighbor who, not content with taking him by the throat and giving him a good beating, had shouted "Demande pardon," while threatening him with death. Little observations of this kind gave me the comforting assurance that national pride, even in France, is not a quality of the masses. 2 years later, when we returned to our native land after honorable and exacting warfare, the knowledge of this helped me to get over the remarkable reception that some of our own people gave us. As the English officer very justly remarked to me in front of the trenches at Monchy, "Il y a de cochon partout." The second company was now under command of Lieutenant Boyer. We spent our days here in the happy atmosphere of good fellowship. I must own that we often drank heavily, until indeed we treated the whole world as no more than a laughable phantom that circled round our table. There were usually also uproarious sounds from the room occupied by our batmen. Those who have never known the brief spells that separate one murderous battle from another may hold up their hands at us if they please. In any case, we were glad to indulge ourselves and our men with every hour of debauch that life would yield while we were still within its circle. I shall not be taken for a dipsomaniac, though I mention drink so often. I have never flouted the time-honored and social rights of the bottle. At the same time, both before the war and since, I have often gone for months without drinking at all. But at the front, one came out of the line covered with mud and in a bad temper, to have the few days on rest taken up in training. And then the night came in the mess, and the present was blotted out, and only memory and hope were lit up. All the devastation of every kind that surrounded one was seen in the light of humor and in a state of bliss, however fleeting it might be, and was finally lost altogether in that light-hearted independence of time that attends upon every toper. One broke through time, menacing and oppression as it was, and rejoiced for an hour or two in a boundless world. The world left one with two memories, as I am sure every outspoken soldier of it will agree, that were always recurring. One, when one was faced with the worst moments it had to offer. The other, when the bottle went round as madly and merrily as ever it did in times of peace. It was only because these black and red threads were interlaced in fairly equal proportions that the experiences of the war were not intolerable. For the coming spell in the line, I was appointed as scouting officer, and with a scout troop and two NCOs, was under the orders of the division. On the 8th of November, the battalion moved in pouring rain to Gonneleu. There, the scout troop was detached to Liaromont and put under the command of the divisional intelligence officer, Captain Beckelmann. The captain, with us four scout officers, two observation officers, and his adjutant, was quartered in the priest's house. There we lived very happily together in comfortably furnished rooms. Our predecessors took us over the divisional front. We had to go up the line every second night. Our task was to ascertain exactly where the front line ran, and to see that communications were maintained, so that if the need arose, we should be able to take the troops into the line and carry out orders in an emergency. My sphere of action was a sector left of Saint-Pierre Vaast Wood, and immediately in front of the so-called Nameless Wood. The first night, after nearly drowning myself in crossing a marsh flooded by the Tortille, I got into a thick cloud of phosgene shell gas, and scurried back with weeping eyes to Vaux Wood. On the way I fell into one shell hole after another, as I could see nothing through the misted eyepieces of the mask. On the 13th of November, hoping for better luck, I set out again on my second tour of the line. My orders were to ascertain that touch was maintained between the shell holes that constituted the front line. I struggled to my goal along a chain of posts concealed in holes in the ground. The shell hole line deserved its name. A plateau in front of the village of Roncourt was pockmarked with innumerable miniature craters, which here and there were occupied by two or three men. The monotony of the scene, where nothing was heard but the whistle and crash of shells, filled the mind with the dread of its utter desolation. After some time I lost touch with the line of shell holes and went back in case I walked into the French. Soon after I came upon an officer I knew in the 164th Regiment, who warned me not to stay any longer now that dawn was breaking. So I hurried on through Nameless Wood, stumbling into deep shell holes and over uprooted trees, and through the almost impassable tangle of branches that covered the ground. When I left the edge of the wood, it was daylight. Before me lay an expanse of shell holes without a sign of life. I stopped short, for in modern battle, stretches of ground where not a man is to be seen are always suspicious. Suddenly a shot from an unseen sniper got me in both legs. I flung myself into the nearest shell hole and bound the wounds with my handkerchief, for needless to say I had forgotten my field dressing. A bullet had passed through my right calf and grazed my left. I crept back into the wood with the utmost caution, and from there limped over the shell-shot ground to the dressing station. Shortly before this, I had an example of the little incidents on which the chances of war turn. I was making for the crossroads about 100 meters ahead of me, when an officer in command of a working party whom I had known in the 9th Company called out to me. We had scarcely been talking for a minute when a shell struck the crossroads, where, but for this chance encounter, I should probably have been at that moment. After dark, I was carried on a stretcher to Nourloo. Captain Berkelman was most kindly waiting for me with a car. We were proceeding along the chaussée in the light of the enemy searchlights when the driver suddenly applied the brakes. A dark obstruction barred the way. It was an infantry section with its NCO, which had just fallen a victim to a direct hit. It seemed as though death had united them in a peaceful sleep. I had to be taken into the cellar of the priest's house, as Lierremont was just receiving its evening benediction. The same evening I was moved to the Villeray Field Hospital, and thence to the War Hospital at Valenciennes. The hospital was installed in the gymnasium near the station and accommodated 400 severe cases. A funeral procession with muffled drums left the main entrance day after day. The whole misery of the war was concentrated in the spacious operating theatre. The surgeons carried on their sanguinary trade at a row of operating tables. Here a limb was amputated, there a skull chiselled away, or a grown-in bandage cut out. Moans and cries of pain sounded through the room in the flood of remorseless light, while nurses in white hastened busily from one table to another with instruments and dressings. The soldiers, who, after such a sight, goes back under fire with ardour unquenched, has indeed withstood a test of nerve, for every fresh and terrible impression claws itself into the brain, and is added to the prostrating complex of imaginings that make the moment between the rush and the burst of a shell ever more frightful. Next to my bed, a sergeant major, who had lost a leg, lay dying. In his last moments he woke from delirium and got the nurse to read him his favourite chapter of the Bible. Then, in a voice scarcely audible, he asked all his ward companions to forgive him for having so often awakened them from sleep by his delirious ravings. And then, just before he died a few minutes later, he tried to cheer us all up with an imitation of our orderly's comic dialect. I was glad when, after 14 days, I was able to leave this abode of piled-up agonies with my wound half-healed. I had read with pride, meanwhile, of the magnificent and successful attack of the Fusiliers on Saint-Pierre-Vaast Wood. The 111th Division was still holding the same front. There were several explosions as my train trundled into Epilly. The ruins of good trucks lumped up together showed that it was no joking matter. "What is going on here, I say?" asked a captain, sitting opposite me. He had the fresh and rosy air of having been exported straight from home. Without wasting time by a reply, I tore open the door and took cover behind the railway embankment. Fortunately, they were the last ones, and only a few horses were wounded. As I could not walk very well, I was given the post of observation officer. My field of observation was over the fallen ground between Nourloo and Moiselin. I had a periscopic telescope built into a shelter, and with this I kept a lookout in the front line that I already knew well. My job was to ring up the division in case of heavy fire, coloured lights, or any other unusual events. All day long I crouched, freezing, on a chair behind the glasses in the November mist, with nothing to vary the monotony except an occasional call to test the wires. If the wire had been broken, I had to leave it mended by my breakdown squad. Apart from this, I had nothing to do but wait for the moment of an attack. The modern battlefield is like a huge sleeping machine with innumerable eyes and ears and arms, lying hidden and inactive, ambushed for the one moment on which it all depends. Then from some hole in the ground a single red light ascends in fiery prelude. 1,000 guns roar out on the instant, and, at a touch, driven by innumerable levers, the work of annihilation goes pounding on its way. Orders fly like sparks and flashes over a close network, spurring on to heightened destruction in front and bringing up from behind a steady stream of fresh men and fresh materials to fling into the flames. Everyone feels that he is caught in a vortex which draws him on, and thrusts him with unrelenting precision over the brink of death. Every 24 hours I was relieved by another officer and betook myself to Nulu, where fairly comfortable quarters had been rigged up in a large wine cellar. I often think of those long, meditative November evenings which I spent smoking my pipe alone at the hearth of this barrel-shaped vault, while outside the mist dripped from the bare trees in the park, and at long intervals a re-echoing report broke the stillness. On the 8th of November, the division was relieved, and I went back to the regiment, now on rest in the village at Fresnoy-le-Grand. There I took over the command of the 2nd Company in place of Lieutenant Boyer, then on leave. The regiment had 4 weeks of undisturbed rest in Fresnoy, and everyone did his best to enjoy it to the full. Christmas and New Year were celebrated by the companies with great festivities, at which beer and grog flowed in rivers. There were exactly 4 men left in the 2nd Company who had spent the previous Christmas with me in the line before Monchy. I was billeted on a French rentier, in whose house I shared the so-called salon, and 2 bedrooms with Fenrich Gornick and my brother Fritz, who was spending 6 weeks with the regiment as cadet. We made ourselves very merry over the worthy married couple, who kept an argus-eyed watch over their plush furniture and alabaster vases, and over their stack of wood in the yard, and who lived on terms of ceaseless animosity with the Batman. In this little retreat, the bottle went round faster than ever. At night, when walking late through the narrow streets, one heard the sounds of carnival in every billet. Everything in wartime goes without reckoning, and hence came the preference of the soldier at the front for alcohol in its most concentrated forms. Our relations with the civil population, too, were, to a great extent, of an undesirable familiarity. Venus deprived Mars of many servants. Needless to say, we were at once put on a footing of old Prussian discipline, and it said a great deal for officers and men that after 14 days the regiment was once more at its old level. There was an inspection by the commander of the division, Major General Sontag. On this occasion, the regiment was honored for its valiant conduct in the attack on Saint-Pierre-Vaast Wood, and distinguished by a number of decorations. As I marched past the general at the head of the 2nd Company, I observed that Colonel von Oppen appeared to make some remark about me to the general. A few hours later, I received orders to report at divisional headquarters, where the general handed me the Iron Cross of the 1st Class. On the 17th of January, 1917, I was sent from Fresnoy on a 4 weeks company commander's course at Sisson, near Lyon, where there was a French maneuvering ground. Captain Funk, who was in command of our detachment, made the work exceedingly pleasant. He understood to an exceptional degree how to put the spirit above the letter and to interest us in the matters in hand. The catering was certainly the sorriest I ever experienced in the course of the war. During the whole 4 weeks there was seldom anything put on the table of our gigantic mess room but watery boiled Swedes. At the same time, the work was by no means light. The Somme Retreat. On my return to the regiment, which had for some days been in the line near the ruins of Villers-Carbonel, I was given temporary command of the 8th Company. Our rest place was Devise. On the march from there to the line, one had to cross the plain of the Somme near the villages of Brie and Saint-Christ. The dreary devastation of these places in the midst of the melancholy marsh country used to put me in a peculiarly sorrowful mood as dark fragments of cloud chased across a moonlit sky, and the eerie interplay of light and shadow heightened the impression of chaos. During the latter part of the time, our front was exposed to numerous English attacks connected with the great evacuation of the Somme area, for which we had made the most careful preparations. The enemy raided nearly every morning to ascertain whether we were still there. The following are a few of the experiences of those days. 1st March, 1917. During the morning, there was great artillery activity owing to the clear weather. In particular, a heavy battery, with the help of balloon observation, pretty well flattened the section of trench occupied by No. 3 platoon of my company. In the afternoon, in order to mark up any alteration of the line on my map, I splashed along to No. 3 platoon through the utterly waterlogged, unnamed trench. On the way, I saw a giant yellow sun rush down to the ground, trailing a black streamer behind it. An airman had attacked the unpleasant balloon and shot it down in flames. He got back in spite of a storm of fire. In the evening, Lance Corporal Schnau came to report that he had detected a sound of pickaxes for 4 days past, underneath his section's dugout. I forwarded the report and was sent a pioneer detachment with a listening apparatus, but our suspicions were not confirmed. Later we heard that our whole position had been undermined. On the 5th of March, a patrol approached our trench in the early morning and began to cut our wire. Lieutenant Eisen, with a few men, hurried off to warn the nearest post and threw bombs. The enemy patrol then took to flight, leaving 2 men behind them. One, a young lieutenant, died immediately. The other, a sergeant, was severely wounded in the arm and leg. It appeared from papers found on the officer that he belonged to the Royal Munster Fusiliers. He was very well clothed, and his features, though distorted in death, were intelligent and energetic. It affected me to find the addresses of several London girls in his pocketbook. We buried him behind our trench and put a simple cross at his head. I saw from this that all patrols need not end so fortunately as mine had done in days past. Next morning the English, after a short artillery preparation, attacked the front of the next company, commanded by Lieutenant Reinhardt, with 50 men. The enemy crept up to the wire. Then one of them, who had a striker attached to his cuff, made a light signal in order to silence the English machine guns, and the whole party threw their last bombs and advanced on the trench. The men received them in such a masterly fashion that only one of them got into the trench. He ran straight through to the second line, and there, when he made no reply to the summons to give himself up, he was shot. Only a lieutenant and a sergeant got through the wire. The officer, though he wore a steel shirt under his uniform, was accounted for by a bullet point-blank from Reinhardt's revolver that drove a whole steel plate into his body. The sergeant had both legs nearly torn off by a bomb. Nevertheless, he clenched his short pipe between his teeth with stoical calm until he died. Here, as always, whenever we encountered the English, we encountered brave men. During the morning of this success, I was strolling through the trench, and saw Lieutenant Pfaffendorf, who was controlling the fire of his trench mortar with a periscopic telescope from a fire step. I had scarcely joined him when I saw an Englishman walking along over the top behind the third line of the enemy trenches. His khaki uniform showed up distinctly on the horizon. I seized the nearest rifle, sighted it at 600, got the man in the tip of the foresight, and then, aiming a bit in front of his head, I pulled the trigger. He went 3 steps, and then fell on his back as though his legs had been knocked from under him. After a few movements of his arms, he rolled into a shell hole, where, with the glass, we could see his brown sleeves showing up for a long while after. On the 9th of March, our front was properly plastered with shells. I was awakened in the early morning by the heavy firing, and seizing my revolver, went, dazed with sleep, into the trench. When I pulled aside the ground sheet at the top of the dugout steps, it was still as black as pitch. The bright flashes of the guns and the showers of earth woke me up in no time. I ran through the trench, but not a soul did I see till I came to a deep dugout, where a group of men crowded on the steps like hens crowding together in the rain, with no one in command. On such occasions, the Prussian way is the best. Pitch into the men, and so get yourself going too. I took them with me, and soon made the trench look lively. I was delighted to hear little Humbrook's piping voice somewhere along the trench, occupied in the same way as I was. When the firing died down, I went back to my dugout in a bad temper. And there I was further ruffled by a telephone call from headquarters. "What the hell is up? Why have you been all this time coming to the phone?" Keeping in touch is no doubt most important, but fighting, after all, is action first and last. After breakfast, there was more of it. This time, HEs were slowly but incessantly being plonked down in front of our noses. At last it became boring, so I paid little Humbrook a visit by an underground gallery, and after seeing what he had to drink, I sat down with him to a game of 7-4. We were a little upset once by a giant crash. It sounded as though a drunken gang came tumbling over each other down the steps. Lumps of earth clattered through the door and down the stovepipe. The dugout shaft had got hit, and the timber revetment was shivered to matchwood. Sometimes a suffocating smell of bitter almonds blew down the shaft. Were they shooting prussic acid at us? Well, good luck to them. I had to leave the dugout once. Indeed, I made 4 attempts in all, owing to constant interruption by the shells. Immediately after, the batman bounced in with the announcement that the latrine had disappeared beneath a direct hit. "Well," said Hombrook, "you do have the devil's own luck." The fire ceased towards evening. I went along the trench in the mood I always experienced after being heavily shelled, a mood like the relief one feels after a violent storm. The trench looked pretty bad. Stretches of it were entirely filled in. 5 dugout shafts were smashed up. Several men were wounded. I went to see them and found them all fairly comfortable. There was one man killed. His body lay in the trench covered with a ground sheet. A long splinter had torn his left hip away, though he was standing right at the bottom of the dugout steps. In the morning we were relieved. On the 13th I was entrusted by Colonel von Oppen with the honorable task of holding the company front with a patrol of 2 sections until the whole regiment had crossed the Somme. Each of the 4 sectors of our front was to be held by a similar patrol under the command of an officer. The officers, starting from the right flank, were Reinhardt, Fischer, Lorick, and myself. The villages we passed through as we marched to the front line had the appearance of lunatic asylums let loose. Whole companies were pushing walls down or sitting on the roofs of the houses throwing down the slates. Trees were felled, window frames broken, and smoke and clouds of dust rose from heap after heap of rubbish. In short, an orgy of destruction was going on. The men were chasing round with incredible zeal, arrayed in the abandoned wardrobes of the population, in women's dresses, and with top hats on their heads. With positive genius they singled out the main beams of the houses, and tying ropes round them, tugged with all their might, shouting out in time with their pulls, till the whole house collapsed. Others swung hammers and smashed whatever came in their way, from flower pots on the window ledges to the glasswork of conservatories. Every village up to the Siegfried line was a rubbish heap. Every tree felled, every road mined, every well fouled, every watercourse dammed, every cellar blown up or made into a death trap with concealed bombs, all supplies or metal sent back, all rails ripped up, all telephone wire rolled up, everything burnable burned. In short, the country over which the enemy were to advance had been turned into an utter desolation. The moral justification of this has been much discussed. However, it seems to me that the gratified approval of armchair warriors and journalists is incomprehensible. When thousands of peaceful persons are robbed of their homes, the self-satisfaction of power may at least keep silence. As for the necessity, I have, of course, as a Prussian officer, no doubt whatever. War means the destruction of the enemy without scruple and by any means. War is the harshest of all trades, and the masters of it can only entertain humane feelings so long as they do no harm. It makes no difference that these operations, which the situation demanded, were not very pretty. On the 13th, I took over with my two sections the front that the second company now left to me. During the night, a man with the ominous name of Kirchhoff was killed by a shot through the head. This unlucky shot happened to be the only one fired by the enemy during several hours. I did all I could to deceive the enemy as to our strength. A few shovelfuls of earth were thrown over the top, now at one point, now at another, and our machine gun had to fire a few shots, first from the left, then from the right. Nevertheless, our fire sounded extremely thin when a low-flying scout crossed the line or a working party traversed our front behind the enemy's trenches. Consequently, patrols appeared every night at one point or another, and said to work tampering with our wire. On the last day but one, I nearly met a sorrowful end. A dud shell from an anti-aircraft gun came hurtling down and exploded on the traverse against which I was innocently leaning. The rush of air sent me flying into the entrance of a deep dugout exactly opposite, where I came to in a state of utter stupefaction. On the 17th in the early morning we could tell that an attack was imminent. Then the English front line, usually unoccupied owing to the mud, was to be heard the clatter of many feet. The laughter and shouting showed that they were a strong party and well fortified from within. Presently dark figures approached our wire. They dispersed under our fire, and one collapsed with a cry and was left behind. I withdrew my men to the entrance of a communication trench, and was kept busy in illuminating our front, now suddenly under artillery and trench-mortar fire with very lights. As the white soon gave out, we made a fireworks display with colored ones. When 5 o'clock came, the hour at which, according to orders, we were to evacuate the trench, we quickly blew up the dugouts with bombs, insofar as they were not already provided with infernal machines, some of which we had ingeniously constructed. During the last hours I had not dared to touch any box or door or bucket, in case I might go up in the air. At the appointed time, all the patrols, some of them already involved in bombing engagements, retreated towards the Somme. We were the last to cross the river, and then the bridges were blown up by an engineer detachment. The drum fire still raged away on our front, and it was some hours later when the first enemy patrols appeared on the Somme. We retired behind the Siegfried position, then still being constructed. The battalion was quartered in the village of Laucourt on the Saint-Quentin Canal. I occupied, with my batman, a comfortable little cottage where the household goods were still stored away in chests and cupboards. I should like to put on record, to show what sort of fellows ours were, that nothing I could say would induce my batman, the trusty Knigge, to make his bed in the warm sitting-room. He insisted all the time on sleeping in the cold kitchen. This attitude of reserve, which is typical of the Lower Saxon, made the relations between officer and man work very smoothly. The first evening out on rest I invited a party of my fellow officers to drink mulled wine, spiced with all the spices left behind by the owner of the house. For our rear guard had earned the praise of all our superior officers, and 14 days' leave as well. In the village of Frenoy. My leave, on which I went a few days later, was this time not curtailed. I find in my diary this brief but eloquent record. Leave spent very happily. Need have no reproaches on that score after my death. On the 9th of April, 1917, I returned to the 2nd Company, then quartered in the village of Merigny, not far from Douai. The pleasure of my return was dashed by an unexpected alarm which had, for me, the peculiarly unpleasant consequence that I had to ride the company charger to Beaumont. Through rain and sleet I rode at the head of the transport that slipped all over the paved road till we reached our destination at 1 in the morning. When I had seen to my horse and the men as well as I could, I went in search of quarters for myself. But there was not an unoccupied corner to be found. At last a commissariat orderly had the excellent idea of offering me his bed, as he had to sit up for the telephone calls. While I was pulling off my boots and spurs, he told me that the English had captured Vimy Ridge, and a lot of ground from the Bavarians. I could not help observing, in spite of his hospitality, that he was not at all pleased to find his quiet village headquarters turned into an assembly point for the fighting troops. The next morning the battalion marched in the direction of heavy firing to the village of Frenoy. There I received orders to set up an observation post. I took a few men and explored the western outskirts of the village and found a cottage in whose roof I had a lookout post made that commanded the front. We took the cellar as our dwelling place, and in the course of making room there we came upon a sack of potatoes, a very welcome addition to our scanty provisions. My batman now roasted me potatoes every evening, with salt. Lieutenant Gornick, also, like a true friend, sent me a large parcel of leberwurst and some red wine. He had found them among the stores left behind in haste in Villaval, which had already been evacuated, but which Gornick was holding as an outpost with one platoon. I at once equipped an expedition furnished with perambulators and similar means of transport to secure this treasure. Unfortunately, it returned empty-handed, as the English were already in full strength on the edge of the village. Gornick told me later that after the discovery of a large cellar of red wine, a drinking bout had started, which, in spite of the attack then made on the village, it had been extremely difficult to bring to a close. On the 4th of April, I was given the task of organizing an intelligence clearing station in the village. For this purpose I had dispatch riders, bicyclists, telephone and light signal stations, underground telegraph wires, carrier pigeons, and a chain of very light posts placed at my disposal. I looked out a suitable cellar with a deep dugout and returned for the last time to my dwelling place on the western edge of the village. During the night I fancied I heard a crash now and then and shouts from my batman. But I was so dazed with sleep that I only murmured, "Oh, let them shoot," and turned over, though the whole place was thick with dust. Next morning I was awakened by little Schultz, Colonel von Oppen's nephew, who was shouting, "I say, don't you know yet that your whole house has been blown to blazes?" When I got up and surveyed the damage, I observed that a shell of the heaviest caliber had been planted on the roof, and that the observation post, indeed the whole house, was no more. If the velocity had only been a trifle slower, the hit would have got us in the cellar and plastered the walls with us, so that in the nice saying of the trenches, we might have been scraped off with a spoon and buried in the pot. Schultz told me that his orderly said to him, when he saw the ruins of the house, "There was a lieutenant in there yesterday. Better have a look and see whether he is there still." My Batman was beside himself at the way I had slept through it. During the morning we shifted our quarters into the new cellar. On the way we were nearly hit by the church tower, which the engineers were unobtrusively blowing up in order to deprive the enemy of an easy mark. In a neighboring village they had forgotten to warn a post of two men who were keeping a lookout from the top of the tower there. By a miracle they were retrieved uninjured from the debris. We furnished our roomy cellar very passably, for we collected what we required from mansion or cottage, and what we had no use for we burned in the stove. During the first day there was a succession of duels to the death in the air. They ended nearly every time in the defeat of the English, as Richthofen's battle formation was circling over the neighborhood. Often five or six machines were driven down or shot down in flames. Once we saw the pilot thrown from his machine and fall to the earth as a separate black speck. There were dangers, too, in staring up into the sky. A man of the 4th Company was killed by a falling splinter that hit him in the neck. On the 18th of April, I paid a visit to the 2nd Company in the line. It held a salient in front of the village of Aulieu. Lieutenant Boyer told me that he had only had a single casualty for a long while, as the English shelling was so methodical that it allowed them to sidestep and avoid it every time. After I had wished him all the best, I had to leave the village at the gallop on account of the continuous shooting by the enemy's heavy guns. I stopped 300 meters behind Aulieu to watch the clouds that rose from each hit. They were red or black according to whether brick walls had been pounded or garden soil flung up, and among them was the delicate white of exploding shrapnel. When a few whiz-bangs began falling on the footpaths that connected Aulieu with Renoy, I abandoned the pursuit of further impressions and decamped at full speed, in case I might be slain, as the stock phrase then was in the 2nd Company. I was often making expeditions of this kind, sometimes as far as the little town of Henin-Littard, for during the first 14 days, in spite of my large staff, there was not a single report to communicate. From the 20th of April, Frenoy was shelled by a 30.5-centimeter gun. The shells came over with a perfectly infernal hiss. After each hit, the village was veiled in a huge reddish-brown cloud of picric acid gas. Even the duds caused a small earthquake. A man of the 9th Company, who was surprised by one of them in the courtyard of the chateau, was flung over the trees in the park and broke most of his bones in the fall. In the afternoon the village was shelled with all calibers. In spite of the danger, I could not tear myself from the attic windows of my house. It was a breathless sight to see how small parties and dispatch carriers chased over the shelled area after throwing themselves flat while the ground was flung up on every side of them. When I went into the village after this, one more cellar had been hit and set on fire. The salvage operations recovered only 3 bodies. Near the cellar lay one on its face with the uniform in shreds. The head was torn off and the blood flowed into a puddle of water. When the stretcher-bearer turned the body over to remove any valuables, I could not help seeing that on the stump of the arm there was only a thumb. The enemy artillery became more active every day and left no doubt of an early attack. On the 24th of April, at midnight, I had the following telephone message. 67 from 5 a.m., which meant in our code utmost readiness for an alarm from 5 a.m., so I lay down again, hoping to be all the better prepared for the expected exertions. However, as I was just falling asleep, a shell hit the house and blew in the wall of the cellar stairs and threw the masonry into the cellar. We jumped up and hurried into the dugout. As we crouched on the steps in the light of a candle, disconcerted and weary, the sergeant of my light signalling section, whose post, together with two valuable signalling lamps, had been